Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Bienvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the new episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So today we have an exciting show planned for you with the Twitter questions. We're going to get into the transfer rumors of the week. I know you guys are very interested with summer around the corner. We're going to name our winners and losers from the Serie A weekend. And we're going to end it with a great interview with our friend Andrew Barker from Variety. We took a deep dive on Inter, and man, do they have an exciting end to the season. And then we closed the podcast with a fun discussion on movies. So after you hear me ask him about Roma's run in the Champions League, it's all movies from then on, but I think you'll really enjoy that because we covered a lot of angles. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our great friend, co-host, producer, Alex Goldberg. So I wanted to start here. Of course, yesterday, Juve clinched their 7th title in a row. Congratulations to Allegri and everyone there. So I wanted to get your take, Alex, thinking more of the teams Allegri has had, even the Conte era. Where do you kind of rank this team for Juve when you think of like the recent title winners?
Yeah, it's a good question, David. And I kind of battled myself when I saw this in our outline. I'm going to say they're tied for the third best team Allegri had here at Juve. And the first team I have is the 2014-15 team that lost to Barca in the final. Definitely, yeah. If a couple other things went their way, they definitely could have won. Carlos Tevez was phenomenal that year. Not to say Higuain hasn't been, but just Tevez was so dynamic and had such motivation. I love the way he just buzzed around the pitch. But then most importantly, they had that midfield. And when I say that midfield, yeah, I mean those four midfielders, Pirlo, Marchisio, Pogba, and Vidal. They were incredible, and they won the league by 17 points. Sure, I think they had 87 points that year, but still, they dominated Serie A. So that's the team that I have to put number one, just in my opinion. And then second, I have last year's team. So yeah, you're noticing a trend, the teams that lose in the final. But last year, they were incredible, 91-point season. They lose, of course, to Real Madrid in the final. But David, here's where my bias comes in. Alexandro was awesome last season. He really was. I mean, they had the defense completely intact with Bonucci there with the rest of the BBC. Alexandro was awesome. Dani Alves, yeah, it wasn't great defensively, but he definitely worked when he went to right wing. It really gave them a whole new dimension. Higuain had a great season. So I'm going to take this year's team, and I'm going to tie them with the 15-16 team in between those 2 years that, of course, did lose to Bayern in the Champions League, of course, not in the final. They were a really good team that year. They had 91 points that year. Dybala arrived on the scene, and Pogba, this is from a previous episode where we talked about Pogba, and I said Pogba's best season was that year. He had 8 goals and 12 assists. That was his last year at Juve. But yeah, this year's team is really damn good, just in a different way. They didn't have the classic BBC. They had so many rotating parts to their team this year. Rugani steps in, Benatia steps in, Kwadwo Asamoah becomes a left back. And of course, their midfield was not as certain. It was not as structured than in years past. Yeah. But between Douglas Costa, who, you know, maybe one of the best substitutes I've seen in the sport, at least in my time viewing this game, Dybala really had his moment. So I think this team was right up there with even the previous teams I mentioned. I'm going to say they were tied for third best that Allegri has managed at the club. So that's my answer, David.
Yeah, interesting take, and I love your research. You got very specific. I kind of agree. I think the team against that loss to Barcelona, I think a lot of people expected Juve to have a better chance in Cardiff the 2 years after, but they came much closer to winning then. Clearly, this season's team compared to that one is much better on the wings. Like, it seems to me Juve made a deliberate attempt in recent years to improve on the wings. They've had the best collection of wingers up front that they've had maybe in the club's history. They kept Alexandro. Granted, the right back was a little bit of a turnstile as far as who played, but they were clearly better in the wing, and clearly the big difference was in the midfield, not as good Juve's midfield has progressively gone worse in recent years, and now they, you could almost say that they won despite that. Appreciate the shout-outs you give to Benatia and Rugani. I mean, a lot of people expected Juve's defense to take a substantial step back with Bonucci leaving, and that really wasn't the case. After they lost to Sampdoria 3-0, Allegri really fixed it. So I look at this Juve, definitely a really explosive attack. I think Higuain, you know, when I think of this season in Serie A, he might not have scored a ton of goals. I think he has 16 now, but he had the most important goals of the season were really his. The one against Inter was really the Scudetto clincher. We'll get into it in the winners and losers as well. So he came through in the clutch moments as opposed to scoring consistently a ton of goals over the bad team. So to me, he kind of symbolizes this new Juve in a way. So the other thing I wanted to ask you is, over the weekend, Serie A has really given us so many great storylines this season. Couldn't have worked out better for our podcast. So on Sunday, you know, Inter and Lazio are going to be playing essentially a playoff game for a Champions League spot. Inter has to win to get into the Champions League. And Stefan De Vrij, who is going to be joining Inter next season, it's, I don't know if official is the right word, but it was leaked that Inter already deposited his contract in the league offices, which they could do because he has an expiring contract. So there's a lot of drama for that. So I'm going to ask this question later on in the podcast, our friend Andrew Barker, but I wanted to get your take on this situation, Alex. What do you make of it?
Yeah, this reminds me of when Mario Götze went from Borussia Dortmund to Bayern Munich, and then they played in the final, and he was injured for that match. But I always wondered what would have happened if he was available for that match, because sure, you're still being paid by your current club, but your allegiances are really to your future club. So in my opinion, De Vrij's allegiances right now are to Inter. They really are. I mean, should he play? I'm going to say no, he shouldn't play. I think, you know, if you're going to make a contract so official before the season's end, there has to be some pitfalls. There has to be some downfalls and some things you can't do. And I think if it's that close to official, then no, I'm going to say that he needs to bow out. There's already so many sketchy things that happen in all of these leagues. I think that would just be more fodder for everybody that wants to complain about the system, and for people that complain about referees and how things are run and this is rigged, that is rigged. I think De Vrij should probably not play in it. That's my take, David. How about you?
Yeah, it's a really tough one. You know, if we go by how he played against Crotone, he had a good match, saved a goal for Lazio. You know, he looks motivated, but it definitely would be different facing the team you'll be on next season, and quite frankly, potentially being the guy that keeps him out of the Champions League. So it's a very tough spot. I'm going to go on the fact, my guess is he's going to play and he'll probably put in a good performance, but really, what a wild scenario. I mean, it's really the perfect ending to a really incredible season in Serie A with so many storylines. The league has definitely, the calcio gods have been good to us with the podcast. So very exciting match on Thursday's episodes. We're going to get into this a little bit more. So today we'll get the Inter angle with our friend Andrew Barker, and on Thursday we'll get the Lazio perspective on all this.
All right, David, well, we really are coming to an end here with winners and losers, at least from this Serie A season. But let's get to it. We had a beautiful weekend of Calcio. So who are our winners and losers of episode 112 of the Calcioland podcast?
So an exciting weekend in Serie A. I kind of recapped this in order for what we saw. So on Saturday, we had Benevento, the last home match. We knew they'd be relegated for a while. They gave a great tribute to their players. Their striker, Diabaté, scored another goal. He has 8 goals in 10 matches for Benevento. The team may be going down, but a lot of the players they brought in January, I hope, stay in Serie A because they've been quite good. Diabaté has been a good goal scorer. We saw a former Tottenham midfielder, Sandro. He's been quite good for Benevento as well. And, of course, Sagna, in a really shocking move, signed with Benevento. So the team's been relegated. Congratulations to the fans for the great support. The team, I thought, held themselves quite well in Serie A. Manager De Zerbi made a name for themselves, but hopefully some of these players stick in the top division in Italy. Then we had Sassuolo's shocking win against Inter. So huge shout out to goalkeeper Consigli, was absolutely brilliant in that match. We had defender Acerbi, who's been really, really good this season, played every minute of the Serie A season once again. I thought he was really dominating in that match. And then the two goal scorers, we had Politano, who's been linked to Milan and Napoli, scored his 10th goal of the season, and Berardi, who of course is a big Inter fan, a lot of people may know, and that second goal was a total dagger to Inter. And, you know, I was just wondering, man, I almost forget that Berardi's still only just 23. We've been hearing about him for so long. He definitely has had a difficult season, but that was a nice way for him to end it. So let's see what happens with him in the summer. Then we had some important results in the race to avoid relegation. We'll get into it on Thursday's episode because there's five teams competing, and I put that in air quotes, for the last spot to go down to Serie B. So we had Cagliari with a huge win against Fiorentina in a special match for Davide Astori. Cagliari was his original team. Of course, he was the captain of Fiorentina when he passed away. So big win for Cagliari, big win for Chievo against Bologna on an away match, big win for Udinese at Verona. So all Cagliari, Chievo, and Udinese could still get relegated, but they got some important results there. Crotone may not have won, but they desperately needed that point against Lazio. So shout out to them, and shout out to manager Zenga, who not only gets a point to stay in the race to avoid relegation, but also really helped his former team Inter with that draw, keeping them in the race for Champions League spot. We also want to give a shout out to Sampdoria president Ferrero, who in the match against Napoli literally ran to the pitch to talk to the fans about the racist chant towards the Neapolitan fans. That was really quite the moment. So kudos to Ferrero. And the last winner of the weekend is Belotti, who scored his 10th goal. Been a difficult season for him. He's saying all the right things about wanting to stay at Torino, so hopefully he can get back on track, but at least he got to 10 goals. Flip side to the losers of the weekend, Icardi. Hard not to put him on this list. He's been sensational this season, but if Inter doesn't make the Champions League, a lot of people are going to remember some of the misses that he had against the Sassuolo. Another loser, and this is really a sore loser, would be Sarri. Look, you guys know I love Sarri. I've been talking about him all season, but he's really has poor sportsmanship. Even after Juve won the title, couldn't bring himself to give him any credit at all. Last season, he used to complain about the schedule, how he had to play before Juve. Now this season, he's complained that he had to play after Juve, Napoli, when keep in mind the reason that happens is because Napoli was eliminated from European competitions in the Coppa Italia. So that's why Napoli was playing after Juve for most of the season. So I found it really poor. I love Sarri as a coach. I think he's tremendous. I also respect the fact that he is the manager of Napoli, and that's a city which is really quite peculiar, and it's hard to give credit to Juve when you're their manager, but I thought that was kind of poor sportsmanship on his part. Fiorentina's out of the Europa League race after the home loss to Cagliari, but overall I think they had a very good season. There was one point in the summer where they lost so many players that I was almost thinking they might get relegated. Overall, they had a good season. And the race to avoid relegation, their loss to Torino could be quite devastating. They were looking in pretty good shape going into that match. And the last one, not really implication for the standings, Bologna with the home loss to Donadoni. To me, really an uninspiring season for Bologna. I think they should have done better. I like Donadoni as a manager, but I think it's time for a change there. We might actually see interim Italy coach Di Biagio there next season to replace Donadoni. As much as I like him, I think it's time for a change. All right, so those are winners and losers for the Serie A weekend. Now let's get into some Twitter questions. So not surprisingly, with the transfer window around the corner, we're going to get into a little bit more transfer stuff. As always, you want to send a question for the podcast, please send it in using the CalcioLand hashtags. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start with this one. What can we expect from Roberto Mancini, and can he build a strong team for the 2020 World Cup?
So we're recording this on Monday. Mancini arrived in Italy yesterday, announced his contract with the Russian club was rescinded. He's ready to go. So he's going to be the new manager of the Azzurri. And I have to say, I try to be a reality-based person. I try to always back up my opinion and my takes. I'm like, look, you know, you could disagree. I could be wrong, but I try to always put what I think is a logical explanation to back up what I think is going to happen. And realistically, I have no logical thing to think Mancini will do well as the Azzurri coach. I think, you know, his best trait has been recruiting. He's done a great job of getting his clubs to buy him all the players that he wants. And obviously that's a trait that doesn't help with the national team, but for some reason, and again, I have no rational explanation for this, I actually think he'll do quite well with the Italian national team. I expect a tenure similar to Prandelli's. So he did really well at the Euro, got him to the final. I think there was a lot of hope with what Prandelli was doing. Of course, they did terribly in the World Cup in Brazil. Italy's goal should be really to ramp up for the World Cup in 4 years. But for whatever reason, I'm cautiously optimistic Mancini will do well, but I have no reason to back this up. So my prediction is he's going to end up being like Prandelli, and we'll look back at his tenure as a successful one.
All right, this next question, I'm starting to wonder if any of my fellow Chelsea fans sent in. David, what are the odds Icardi leaves Inter, and is there any hope he'll join Chelsea?
So I think, you know, a lot depends on what's going to happen this weekend with Inter in if they make the Champions League or not. I mean, my guess is if Inter doesn't make the Champions League, Icardi has yet to play in it despite scoring a ton of goals. My guess is if they don't make the Champions League, there's a very good chance to leave Inter. You know, of course, have those financial fair play issues. They could raise a ton of money with Icardi. I mean, when I look at, like, the prices for someone like Dembele or right now, like, Icardi should fetch a huge transfer fee. Now, as far as Chelsea, you know, it would be kind of an odd fit. And, you know, I kind of got into it a little bit on Twitter, too, when people were asking me about Sarri and Allegri to Chelsea. I was like, I wasn't knocking Chelsea, but I was like, look, you could argue that Chelsea not being in the Champions League makes them, you know, less attractive than, say, staying at Napoli or Juve, which are in the Champions League. So when I look at Icardi, he's never played in the Champions League. My guess is if he leaves Inter, it will be to compete in that tournament. So I could be wrong, but, you know, we've seen Manchester United be able to sign a ton of players even without the Champions League, so maybe it falls in that category. If Icardi is going to be sold, you know, technically his agent is Wanda Nara, his wife. I could see Raiola being involved, so that could help some clubs more than others, but it's going to be an interesting scenario. So if you as a fan want to sign Icardi next summer, I would completely root for Lazio over the weekend, because I think that would make the odds of him leaving that much higher.
Listen, Chelsea is a step down right now. I don't want to talk about the broad scheme of things, but they're a step down right now. They were fifth place, no Champions League football. If I'm Icardi, I don't go to Chelsea. No chance. I want UCL football. So next one, David. And I really like this question. What hurts Napoli more, keeping Sarri and losing some of their key players, or keeping the top players and losing Sarri?
It's a great question, and we're going to make this strictly as a hypothetical, because to be honest, I think in a lot of ways, the premise, like the opposite, is kind of true. I think if Sarri stays at Napoli, and that's a big if right now, I think that's at best 50-50. My guess is Napoli will give him reassurances that most of the best players are staying. So, but this is a good hypothetical question. I actually think, in a way, if Napoli were to rebuild and start a new cycle and lose their best players, almost in a way, having Sarri would be good to develop the next batch of players. I think Sarri felt a lot of pressure of winning the Scudetto this season, so didn't rotate much, just put all his focus on making it happen. I think if the expectations are different, I'd be curious to see what would happen. But to answer specifically the question, I think actually, in a way, if Napoli keeps their player and go with a more pragmatic manager, they might be better in the short run. They might not be as exciting to watch play, but they might do better. If anything, they would compete better on multiple fronts. So I think in a way that would be a better outcome than losing the best players and starting with Sarri. So definitely this is a situation to watch. The Sarri situation is really exciting. I'm going to remind people that I would look at Monaco and Liga as a potential destination for him. That's what someone who knows things told me, and that makes a lot of sense to me.
All right, well, let's stay on Napoli, and please, God, do not let this happen. How likely are Napoli to sell Jorginho to Manchester City?
So this was the first big transfer story of the summer on DiMazzo's site. It was really exciting. I think it was Thursday or Friday morning. I was getting ready for work, and Gianluca dropped the bomb that Man City had made the initial approach to Napoli. So not surprising to me, Napoli asked a ton for Jorginho, 60 million euro, and I think Manchester City had a little bit of a sticker shock for it. But to be honest, anyone that's been paying attention to Napoli shouldn't be surprised in the least. They are notorious for asking huge amounts of money for their best players. And you know what? They have good reason for this, because unlike the vast majority of Serie A clubs, Napoli has no financial problems whatsoever. You know, you can criticize President De Laurentiis all you want. He took that club. They were basically bankrupt, turned them into a very stable club. They've broken even on the transfer market basically almost every year except for one. So they're in great shape. They have the guaranteed Champions League revenues. They're going straight to the group stage. They've known that for a while. So to me, it should come to no surprise that Napoli is asking a lot for their best players. As far as I know, Jorginho doesn't have an exit clause, while some of their other players like Mertens, Hizaj, Albiol, they have exit clause. So it doesn't surprise me that Napoli is playing a lot of hardball for Jorginho. I think this is one to watch. There's a lot of Premier League clubs that like him, and Napoli, of course, have Diarra backing him up. So it would make sense to me that Napoli would cash in on Jorginho. Just don't expect a low price, that's for sure.
All right, this next question I'm going to ask really begrudgingly. Considering that Asamoah would join Inter, how likely are Juve to sell Alexandro to Manchester United?
So, yeah, I've been getting a lot of questions on Manchester United. And, look, you know, as far as I know, there's no deal done for this. If you guys have been listening to the podcast or following my work, you know, the one point that I make pretty often is if you look at Juve's history, they never sell a big name, or there's never really even a lot of buzz on them potentially selling a big name, even in the Italian press, till after their season ticket campaign ends, which is usually in the middle of July. When Juve has sold some big names, Vidal, Pogba, players like that, or even when Conte abruptly left, oh, it was kind of a coincidence, but right after the season ticket campaign started. So I wouldn't expect a lot of buzz on Juve till after that. So I think there's a pretty good chance that Alexandro leaves, but I wouldn't expect anything imminent. As far as that, you know, if I'm a Juve fan, compared to this time last year, the way Alexandro was playing, losing him would have been an absolutely devastating proposition. This season, with the way he played, it maybe doesn't look as bad. They also have Spinazzola coming in from Atalanta. They've been linked to Darmian from Manchester United, of course. They brought in the PSV right back, Santiago Arias, who can also play on the left. They, of course, have De Sciglio, who can play at left back. They're trying to play Cuadrado at right back. So you're seeing a lot of movement at the wing back positions for Juve. To answer specifically the question, I thought Asamoah was better than Alexandro this season. It was no surprise that he started a lot of the big games. But I don't think there's a big impact between Alexandro and Asamoah, again, because Juve has Spinazzola coming in and they're looking a lot a left back. So I wouldn't put a lot of connections between the two things. Let's see what happens with Alexandro. But as far as I know, there's nothing imminent in the works.
Yeah, Santiago Arias looks like a really nice player from PSV. And Alexandro update, which happened while we were recording, he is not on the Brazil squad for the World Cup.
Sure.
So my boy just being disrespected left and right. All right. Next Twitter question. David, have you heard the Arctic Monkeys' new album, Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino?
So shout out to our friend Aaron, the Napoli guest we had a few weeks ago. But great scout, great friend of the podcast. So he suggested I listen to this album. I had read about how this was a departure, not really a rock album by the Arctic Monkeys. Like, I'm not a huge fan of theirs, but I do like some of their songs. So I listened to it this morning coming into work. And the first thing that I thought of listening to most of the songs is this podcaster, this writer that I really like, Larry Widmore, has a thing that, you know, titles are so important. Like, if you have a great title of an article or a book, it's like halfway there. And I think the title of this album is absolutely perfect, because when you listen to the first few songs, the vibe of the album is exactly that, Tranquility-based hotel and casino. The way I describe it, this album gives me nostalgia for a place that I've never been at before. It just really takes you in a pretty unique place. And you know what I really like about music is it's like it's so subjective, like your background, your life experience. experiences really determine the visuals that you have for music. So again, you know, it kind of made me think of like a Supertramp album from the 70s, like kind of a weird band like that. The lead singer of Arctic Monkeys, Alex Turner, sounds like David Bowie quite a bit on this album. So it almost felt like Supertramp, David Bowie album in a Stanley Kubrick science fiction movie. That's kind of the place this album took me in. I really dug it. I listened to it twice today, so I recommend it, but do not expect a rock album out of this one, that's for sure.
All right, David, last Twitter question. Did Metallica make the right move by hiring Bob Rock as their producer in the early 90s?
So this came up over the weekend. I was in the gym. I was listening to Sirius, their rock station, and something off Dr. Feelgood, a Motley Crue album, came on. And I love that album. It's probably my favorite produced album. The production of that album was really amazing. And every time I hear a song off that, I just picture Lars and Metallica trying to tell James, look, you know, we need to hire Motley Crue's producer to take us to the next level. And if you know about Metallica's history, it's like really pretty funny to think that. I mean, Metallica had songs, you know, called like Creeping Death, A Master of Puppets, you know, Disposable Heroes, like really, you know, serious stuff. And, you know, Motley Crue, Bob Rock was doing songs like She Goes Down, like very different things. So I just imagine Lars trying to tell James, you know, this is the guy that's going to take us to the next level. And quite frankly, I think Metallica did the right thing back then. It was really controversial. It was about 30 years ago, Metallica decided to become a much more commercial band and kind of ditch their really long, heavy songs and have more songs for a radio format. And I think Bob Rock really was the guy to bring them in that direction. I don't think Metallica becomes like, you know, one of the biggest selling tour acts in North America. If they aren't the highest selling band of the past 25 years, they have to be up there. They've packed huge stadiums. I feel like, you know, a lot of people got familiar with Metallica from the Black Album and listened to some of their old stuff. I think that benefited a lot of other bands in that genre. So I think it was the right thing to do for Metallica. I think, you know, they got a lot of crap from some of their hardcore fans. But I think, you know, if you go see Metallica live today, they still play a lot of their old songs. So I think that was the right thing to do. You know, it's interesting to me how Bob Rock, like, really gave us the new Metallica. And I think ultimately in 20 years, people are going to remember Metallica more from the big songs from the Black Album, like Enter Sandman, Unforgiven, Sad But True, than some of their old albums. So he gave us that. And in a way, he also gave us the Pam Anderson porn tape, because he really made Tommy Lee into a superstar with the drum sound on Dr. Feelgood. Really amazing. You haven't heard that album in a while. I recommend it. The production is just amazing. I was then listening to the Black Album, because when I listen to Metallica on my phone, it's usually live stuff. And I was listening to the Black Album, the production, really amazing how different that was from Metallica. You even hear keyboards quite a bit on that album. So quite the departure, but I think in the long run, that was the right thing to do for Metallica. So I want to take this opportunity to thank all our listeners. Please keep subscribing, reviewing the podcast, and sending in questions. We're going to end with a great interview with our friend Andrew Barker from Variety. We're going to get into Inter and then talk about summer movies. So enjoy. I think by now all of you guys know how excited I am when Andrew Barker comes on the podcast, because not only do we get to talk about culture, we're going to get into some pop culture. As you guys know, he's been on the podcast many times. He's a senior features writer at Variety, one of the biggest connoisseurs of pop culture that I have the pleasure of knowing. So it's great to have you back. Welcome back to Culture Land, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, David. Really appreciate it. And just a quick note. So my wife was out of town all weekend, which meant that I was home alone with a very hyperactive 3-year-old. So I barely survived. And so if I start like suddenly speaking in tongues or something, just sort of let me know and drag me back down.
Sounds good.
But appreciate you having me.
Awesome. So this was for those that aren't too familiar with Andrew's appearances on the podcast before. He's a big Inter fan, and we love always getting his perspective on the team. The last time you were on, Andrew, was right around the Oscars. So I want to say that was the first week in March or so. Inter's had a lot of ups and downs since then, including this weekend. So I would imagine after the loss to Sassuolo on Saturday, you must have felt like the Champions League was almost a mirage. But then Walter Zenga saved you with Crotone. So let's get your take on what happened over the weekend and the roller coaster ride that Inter put you on.
You know, it's funny, you know, I watched the match on Saturday and just sort of thought, okay, well, that's it. No need to even really bother watching or even paying attention to Lazio playing on Sunday. And it was actually, I got a Twitter message from you about being on this podcast, and I hadn't been on Twitter all day. And so I sort of, you know, checked in, and I was kind of, a lot of the Inter accounts I follow were saying things that didn't seem to make any sense to me. And I was like, seriously, did Lazio not win? And it's just, you know, I think I might have mentioned this before, but this has been such a weird season for Inter, in the sense that instead of the usual thing, which is where everything just seems to go wrong for Inter beyond their control, this season is just like, it's like a cat-like nine lives kind of situation where Inter have just thrown away the season so many times. Like, the season should have been over months ago, like when we went 2 months without winning. Like, that should have been it for us. This should have just been like a, you know, an exhibition, you know, for the next couple months. And somehow, miraculously, no matter how badly we screw things up, we always get that 1 second chance. And so clearly this is the last conceivable extension on our life we can possibly get. And I mean, you know, I'm sure anyone listening here is aware of Inter's history playing Lazio at the Olympico on the last match of the season with everything on the line. It's not a great history, although in a weird way, this is sort of like the inverse. You know, the last time Inter played Lazio on the last match of the season, Inter just needed to draw or win and everything would be fine. And now the onus is on Lazio. So I don't know. I mean, I wonder how much that's going to get into their heads. And Inter has proven itself capable of losing to any team, no matter how much we should beat them, and of beating teams that we have no right to beat. So I don't know. I mean, it's I would never in a million years try to predict things. And I don't even know if I'm going to watch, you know, it's just, it's such a, like, I mean, I'm sure I will, but it's just like, wow, I you know, this should have been over for us so long ago, but here we are.
Absolutely. And look, you know, this match is in of itself, there's a ton of drama just because what's at stake, a Champions League spot, two teams that for different reasons could really use the revenue that comes with it. But here there's a huge wrinkle. And, you know, I've been following Calcio for a long time, to transfer specifically for a long time as well. But the situation with De Vrij is really pretty unique. So for those that haven't followed, like, during the week, it was leaked to Italy's major paper, Gazzetta dello Sport, that Inter already deposited De Vrij's contract for next season. The reason they can do that is he has an expiring contract. You can do that at any time after February. I think, you know, everyone involved would have preferred that this news not really come out, because both teams now, Lazio and Inter, are playing each other with a huge match with a lot at stake. So this is really a lot of drama. We call Inter Pazza Inter, Crazy Inter. So this scenario is really quite unique. So I want to get your take on this. And from your perspective, do you think De Vrij should play? And if he does, what do you expect from him?
It's such a weird situation, as you say. You know, usually I always kind of assume that footballers are professionals. And no matter what future plans they have in mind, and no matter what kind of personal loyalties they have, that a player is always going to do their best for the team that's paying them, you know? So like, say when if you've loaned a player to another team and you don't have a specific clause in the contract saying that they can't play against you, I'd say that's fine. Most normal situations, but this isn't a normal situation. And man, I don't know what you do, because if you're Lazio, you've got to play your full strength side.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, for the player, it sucks the most, actually. I mean, what is he supposed to do? You know, I mean, I think the most Pazza Inter scenario I can imagine would be if Inter win with goals from Kondreva, who hasn't scored all season, scoring against his former club, and then De Vrij scores an own goal. I mean, I think that would be like the ultimate insane conspiracy provoking sort of Pazza Inter solution imaginable. But I don't know what you do. I can see them going either way, and I think that puts De Vrij in just a horrible position, because he's either going to be a villain to Laziale for the rest of his life if he even just makes a slight mistake and doesn't play up to his normal standards. But if he's the one who just helps keep Inter out of the Champions League yet one more time and then has to go ingratiate himself to the fans, how do you deal with that? I don't know. So that I have no solution to that, but it's a bizarre situation.
It's a tough one, yeah. I mean, he played really well. I know you didn't watch. He played really well against Crotone, but this is really even crazier now to face against Inter. On the bright side for him, you know, he plays in Italy, a country where there's no conspiracy theories, no drama, nothing.
Never.
So he'll be fine. It won't escalate no matter what happens. Now, all joking aside, it really is a crazy situation, even for Inter standards. So, you know, I was hoping to talk to you with a little bit more clarity on if Inter's going to be in the Champions League or not, but I think, you know, this is still worthwhile asking. So, you know, we know of De Vrij. We've known Lautaro Martinez is going to come. You know, I think they're going to announce it, you know, with the next fiscal year for financial fair play issues. Asamoah, who's had a really good season for Juve, is expect to come as well. So Inter's off really to a great start in the transfer window. So based on that, you know, do you feel pretty optimistic for the team moving forward? Or do you feel this is like, you know, a great trailer for a film where you're like, geez, this is going to be a fantastic movie, and then it ends up being a disappointment?
I think that that last metaphor you have is really apt. I mean, you know, you look at all three of those players you mentioned, and they're fantastic players. They've had great seasons this past juncture, and all of them would be so incredibly welcome here, you know, whether it's in the defense, whether it's someone who can fly up the wing like Asamoah can. And, you know, I've actually been, just with regard to Lautaro Martinez, you know, I just have to say that I am wrong at least half the time when I'm predicting what Inter's transfers will shape up to be. But one area that I was, I think, correct in was I never believed in Gabigol. There was just something about watching him in Brazil where, you know, as fun as his goals were and as spectacular as some of them were, I just kept watching thinking, like, how often do you get that kind of chance in Italy?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, it's just like he'd be there, he'd be through on goal over and over again. He'd have like enough time to stop and send a text message, you know, between getting the ball and shooting. And it's just like, he's never going to get that chance in Italy. Like, you know, does he have that kind of reservoir of other skills to draw on? And with Martinez, I've you know, ever since his name started being floated for Inter in the winter, I've been trying to watch him as much as possible. I think he's going to do well. I think he has a style that will be easily adaptable to Serie A. Like, he just scores so many kinds of goals. You know, he scores like these long range screamer goals, and he has that kind of instinct that I don't want to compare him to like Diego Milito or anything, but that Milito had, where without doing anything particularly fancy, he would just be able to get the ball under heavy marking and just give himself like a foot of space to make a shot, and he'd get the shot off. And so I'm really excited about him. However, in other words, like, I think Inter has already addressed so many of their most glaring deficiencies.
Yeah.
I think all they really have left to do is just a little more sort of a backup in general, and especially in the midfield. But I mean, for the transfer window not even being open yet and to have these three names pretty much nailed down is pretty impressive, but it's Inter, so who knows?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me is, you know, there's the uncertainty if they'll be in the Champions League or not. But for me, when I look at these moves, they've hedged themselves really, really well. Because, you know, if they have to sacrifice Skriniar, if they get an offer they can't refuse, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better replacement than De Vrij. Kind of in a way, too, Icardi. I mean, if they sacrifice him, Lautaro Martinez on paper looks like a great addition. And Asamoah, I mean, there's been a hole at left back for a while. So for me, no matter what happens on paper, Inter has hedged really well. So I wanted to ask you about Icardi, and granted, we don't know if they'll be in the Champions League or not, but I wanted to get your sense in general with him. Obviously, he's had another spectacular season. The match against the Swallow definitely wasn't his finest hour, but overall, I'd say his value has really gone up this season. Now, even people that weren't that familiar with Serie A know about him. Do you kind of see him as a guy that you're like, it's so hard to find strikers like that can guarantee you so many goals, we can't let him go no matter what? Or do you look at it as, you know, we've had him for a while, we haven't been to the Champions League yet with him, let's just try something else? What's your take on that?
My take on that is, I honestly don't know. I mean, especially if we don't get into the Champions League, I can't think of a single center forward of Icardi's level who would be willing to come play for us, honestly. I mean, if you throw a ridiculous amount of money into the mix there, of course, things change. But I think he's someone to hold on to at all costs. I mean, he scored, I think it's something like 45% of Inter's total goals this season, which is just an insane number. And I don't think any other club in the league has anything, a player who's that just essential to their offense.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's replaceable for us as of yet. And I really worry if we don't make the Champions League, just what that does to his calculation. You know, I mean, I think a lot about the fact that it seems like he's not likely to be going to the World Cup. And yeah. I wonder what that does to him psychologically, because it's one of those crazy things when you think about it, but you know, Icardi is like the definition of like an early bloomer, like a prodigy. You know what I mean? Like even when he was with Sassuolo, I think he was like 20 the first time he scored double digit goals in Italy. He was the youngest player since Paolo Rossi to get a scoring title. I think he was 22. I think if he scores a single goal next week, he will be, I believe, and you can check me on this, I think he'll be the youngest player ever to get two scoring titles in Serie A ever.
Yeah, that sounds so about right.
So when you look at someone who is that good, that young, and yet if he doesn't make the World Cup squad this year, that means the first World Cup he'll go to potentially will be when he's 29.
Yeah.
You know, which is nuts when you think about someone who's that good, that young, just not being able to break in. So if I'm Icardi, I'm looking at how well I've played for the last couple of seasons, how good I've been that young, and the fact that I still haven't played in the Champions League or the World Cup, and I'll think, what am I doing at this club? You know what I mean? Like I'm doing my part, and the fringe benefits that are supposed to come with being a world-class player on this level aren't necessarily coming to me. Maybe I need to make a change. So I'm more worried about him losing faith in the club than I am the club deciding to sacrifice him, honestly, because I don't see how you make that calculation make sense. Lautaro Martinez, I think, is going to be great for Inter. I don't think he's going to provide 45% of our total offense anytime soon. So I'm kind of biting my fingernails about the Icardi situation.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that with the World Cup. I mean, they put him on the preliminary squad, but from everything I've heard, he's not going to go to this World Cup. And you have to, that's a very good point that at his age, you know, he'd be 28 his first World Cup. He's got to start wondering if Inter, Serie A, whatever is holding him back, because as you said, his track record really speaks for itself. So I wanted to ask you about Spalletti. Every time you've been on, we've talked about him a little bit. So, you know, I think he gets, you know, a lot of praise, and I'm wondering if maybe almost too much, because if you think about it, I think Inter has the second or at worst the third highest payroll in Serie A. They didn't have European competitions to worry about. Milan didn't make the jump that everyone expected them to. You know, we had Roma definitely have a long run in the Champions League, Lazio fairly long run in the Europa League. So if I'm look at it completely from the outside, not knowing who the manager is, and I think Spalletti, rightfully so, has a good reputation, maybe I'd say this is a little bit of a disappointment and it has to be a little bit on the manager. So let me get your perspective on that, and if you think, you know, he's perceived better than maybe the job he's done this season.
I think so. And I think I agree with you. And I say that as someone who probably does himself rate Spalletti maybe higher than his results indicate. You know what I mean? I don't know what it is about him that, you know, Inter fans are not necessarily polite and patient with their managers. And so I'm not sure why he's gotten so much kind of more leeway than other people in his position. I mean, you know, I think of like the things I give him credit for, like, you know, I mean, I think he finally figured out what Inter's midfield should look like, which it should be, which is not a combination I ever would have come up with. So I'm kind of like, I never would have thought to play Brozovic and Gagliardini together, kind of withdrawn, with then Rafinha being up top there. And I'm like, okay, this actually works. But then on the other hand, I mean, you know, obviously Rafinha wasn't there until the winter window, but it took him till March to come up with the ideal starting 11 for the team. I mean, that's not good, you know, like, you know, after he tried virtually every other player combination he could, you know what I mean? And it took him, you know, at least half a season to start to really integrate Joao Cancelo, who has been arguably the best fullback this team has had in a while. So why the holdup? Why did it take him this long? And how could he not successfully motivate a flawed but decent group of players to play up to their level? It does have to be on the coach. I mean, like, you know, I think it's pretty clear he's going to be here next season, and I have no issue with that because, like a lot of Inter fans, I probably give him more credit than he deserves, but it's a really good point.
So let's talk about a player that I know has been near and dear to you for a while. And when I look at Inter in the past 5-6 years, I'm like, man, they really have missed the player like this one. So yesterday, Thiago Motta announced that this is it for his career. I've always felt he was a massively underrated player. I think Inter, quite frankly, hasn't been the same since. We've seen them try to sign a lot of midfielders that would kind of fit that role, and it never really worked. So I wanted to get your take on what made Thiago Motta such a special player, and if you agree that he's a player, and a lot of people talk about what Inter's missing, I never hear him mentioned, but to me, that's exactly the type of guy they need.
I'm so glad you said that, because I've been saying that for years and people look at me like I'm smoking crack. Like, you know, like, no, it's not Eto'o that we're missing. It's not Schneider that we're missing. We're missing a Thiago Motta. And she's like, what? Thiago Motta? But it's like, you know, I remember hearing this, and I can't remember when this was, so I'm probably messing it up. But someone asked Bob Dylan, like, if he had seen whatever the most recent Rolling Stones tour was. And Dylan, being Dylan, who never responds to questions normally, said, you know, the Stones haven't been a rock and roll band since they lost Bill Wyman. And, you know, if you know anything about the Rolling, like, you know, I'm a bass player, and Bill Wyman's a perfectly fine bass player. But if you were to go through every member of the Rolling Stones who's ever been there, you'd probably think of him as, like, maybe the sixth most important member of the band. I mean, he's fine, you know, like no bass player would ever cite Bill Wyman as their, like, idol. It just doesn't happen. But for Dylan, he just saw that the lack of this, you know, not superstar type player just made the entire band lose something essential, and that they were no longer a rock and roll band. And I kind of feel something similar with Inter just being a coherent midfield, that, yeah, they have not been the same since Thiago Motta. And, you know, as flawed as he was, I mean, Thiago Motta was injured, like, maybe a third of the time. So I understood why they got rid of him. But he had these qualities that are so underrated in a player, especially a midfielder, which is, I mean, on the one hand, he's definitely like the type of player where you despise him unless he's on your team. You know, he's kind of like a Gattuso was for Milan, or like a Lichtsteiner was for Juve, or is for Juve, I guess, still. Where, I mean, yeah, there's absolutely no reason you should appreciate what he's doing if he's playing against you, because he's the most irritating player imaginable. But I think even compared to those types of players, he had an intelligence and almost like a selflessness that I think was different, which sounds weird to say kind of a selflessness, but he was always willing to be the irritant, the bad guy, the kind of the bad sport, you know what I mean? But he wouldn't do it in this aggressively kind of berserker way that, you know, you might've gotten out of like a, you know, a Materazzi, to be honest. I think one of the real standout stats from his time at Inter was that he got, in the 2.5 years he was at the club, he got almost 30 yellow cards, which is a lot. But he was sent off once, and famously sent off undeservedly against Barcelona when Sergio decided to throw himself to the floor. So, you know, you think about people who get that many yellow cards as being undisciplined, but he was actually incredibly disciplined, because he knew, except for that one time that someone even dirtier than him conspired to get him sent off, he knew exactly how much sort of bad sportsmanship to use and exactly when. And whenever on a yellow card, he always had the discipline and the intelligence to never get another one. So I think that's extremely underrated, to have a player, and that comes from being able to read the game. He knew when he needed, he wasn't just sort of lashing out randomly and just sort of raking his studs against players just to be a dick. He knew when the team needed, when the opponents needed to kind of be taken down a level psychologically, when they were about to break and someone just needed to pull a tactical foul. He was that kind of guy. And I think that intelligence also applied to his passing. You know, I mean, like, I don't even know what you would qualify him as. I mean, he's, you know, you could call him a deep lying playmaker or like a regista, but he almost was more invisible than that. You know, he was the guy behind the guy behind the guy. You know, he was the guy who played the pass to the guy who played the pass to the guy who made the key pass that led to the goal. You know, like if you're watching the highlight of an Inter goal from Mata's era, it's probably going to start right after Thiago Mata made a pass, you know. And so his fingerprints were just so slight on everything that Inter did. But as soon as he was gone, his absence was felt. I mean, I think there was like that last half season he played with Inter. There was some crazy stat that Inter won like 90% of the games he started and won 20% of the games he did not start. And that was when he was like looking like he was kind of gassed, you know what I mean? And yet still his presence there, even if he was the slowest guy on the pitch, even if like a slight breeze would make him twist his ankle, he still somehow elevated the team in a way that they've missed. And that they, I mean, where do you find a player like that? I don't know. You can find like kind of bruisers, and you can find sort of a cynical, you know, like kind of quasi criminals, and you can find guys with decent passing, but just with that kind of that ability to read the game, but not that desire to make oneself the hero, to always kind of be the guy pulling the foul or the guy making the small yet necessary pass, I think requires a really specific kind of sensibility as a player. So I've always loved Thiago Mata.
I love the bass player analogy. I think that's actually real. Although that Dylan quote really left me puzzled, but I think that's
right. It doesn't make any sense, right?
It does, but it does make sense in the Dylan way. Yeah. So before we get to movies, which you know I have a ton of questions because you're my go-to guy for that, I wanted to get I have a more of a big picture question on Serie A. So of course we saw Juve win their seventh title. They've done well in the Champions League. They haven't won it, but they've done well. Thinking on Napoli this season, really gave them a good run for their money. I think most other seasons Napoli would have won with the amount of points. We also had Roma had their great run in the Champions League, took out quite a few big name clubs, really did much better than many expected. Do you take kind of that run in the Champions League and to a certain extent the fight Napoli gave to Juve as a sign that Serie A is coming back, or is this more kind of like a fluke? Because I've been putting a lot of thought into this. I think right now Serie A is coming back. The thing missing are the two clubs from Milan, but aside from that, I see a lot of other positive signs. So I wanted to kind of get your take on that thought process.
I see a lot of positive signs too, and I think one of the most important things about Roma having the European campaign they did is that we only see these signs if like you and I, we pay attention to the league. You know what I mean? Because like on the outside, like in the inside, this was in probably the most exciting and interesting and sort of drama-filled season in the league that I can think of in many years. But on the outside, it's almost like everyone kind of did what they were expected to do in the end. You know, like Juve never played like always up to their potential, but they still won like their 35th Scudetto in a row, whatever it is. Napoli played the best football in Europe, but couldn't close the deal in the end. And Inter were Inter, and Milan were a mess. But Roma, I mean, just to have that many eyeballs on them, I think was important. And I go back to like the beginning of the season, and just various sort of Inter fans I know, that there's a lot of speculation that if Inter were going to make the Champions League this season, it would almost certainly be at the expense of Roma. Like just that they had going into the season, you know, they had coaching kind of questions and it was hard to tell what their mercato had been like. And, you know, I mean, they just kept losing all their best players, you know, every year, every time they would really start to stand out. And so to see them not only make the Champions League, but to, I mean, no one expected them to get out of their group in the Champions League, much less make it all the way to knocking Barcelona out in the knockout, much less almost coming back in the semifinal. I mean, no one would have imagined Roma in the semifinal. So I think that really is a testament to how much talent and sort of hidden reserves of excitement kind of lurk in Serie A, even if you're, you know, just an average Premier League fan who just looks and say, oh, Juve won again. Yeah, like, you know, big whoop. I think that will get a lot more attention. And if I'm a Roma fan, I'm intrigued by what they do this summer. I think they're definitely showing for neutrals to watch, you know. I mean, they've got the best goalkeeper in the league and arguably still the best midfielder in the league. And now they've got to kind of believe in themselves a little bit more as opposed to just saying like, okay, Mo Salah had a good season. We're getting some money for him. Let's go for it. I think they might have one of the best young forwards in the league too. He just happened to be injured most of the season. So I think if I'm a neutral, they're a team I'm really going to want to pay attention to next season. And I do think it's a really good sign for the league.
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned on Roma, of course, Schick, who you mentioned. They have another player, Karsdorp, highly rated, tore his knee twice. Mm-hmm. So there's really a lot of optimism. And, you know, not only all the eyeballs they got in the Champions League, but all the huge revenues they got from them, they might really be able to end the cycle of selling their best players. So now let's shift gears. I want to ask you about movies. For those of you that aren't familiar with Andrew, he's a humble guy, but he really is one of the best movie critics. So not only in the U.S., but in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I love reading your takes on movies. Last time we were on, we were chatting about the Oscars. And, you know, I was thinking that that slate of Oscar movies was really the best in quite some time. For me, there was a huge revival from Hollywood. And, you know, usually after the Oscars, it dies down a little bit. We get ready for summer blockbuster season. But instead, you know, we had a ton of movies of interest. You know, I was starting to wonder if, you know, Facebook sold my data to Hollywood and they're making all these movies that I want to see all of a sudden. So after the Oscars, which was a great slate, we had Wes Anderson make Isle of Dogs. We had arguably maybe the best superhero movie ever with Black Panther. We had a horror movie that had huge success in A Quiet Place. We had the Chappaquiddick movie. So really impressive slate for after the Oscars. So I know you were telling me all along that it was a strong year for movies. Has the trend continued, or has Hollywood always been this good and I just wasn't paying enough attention in previous years?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know if I have a coherent answer to it, but it definitely, I mean, even just, you know, from my position, it feels that way. That, I mean, there were years where it felt like studios just kind of weren't trying particularly hard. I mean, they were trying hard to make money, but it was just, I mean, things really were just stratified into these giant tentpole movies where it really doesn't matter if they're any good or not, and then just movies that the studios would pick up out of festivals and throw out there and maybe hope one of them sticks. And I don't know if they're necessarily better, or if it's just that we are that, I mean, obviously the, you know, this is a dumb thing to say, but clearly the internet has, and the word of mouth and the way that spreads has done a lot to change studio marketing. But I wonder if we're not really seeing the effects of that really kick in now, in the sense that you have movies that are mediocre still exist and they're still released, and but they just disappear. You know what I mean? Like no one just shows up to these crappy movies that the studio turns out for $10 million hoping to make $15 million off of them, because no one's talking about them. Whereas a movie like Black Panther was always going to make a lot of money, but the fact that it was actually really good, that sounds dumb to say that a movie did better because it's good, but that hasn't always been the case. And
for
I feel
sure.
like that's maybe more the case now. Where, I mean, a little horror movie like The Quiet Place, I think if that came out 5 years ago, that would have done fine. You know, that would have made its money back and the studio would have been happy with it. But it wouldn't have been the number one movie in the country for several weeks. And that was only because people liked it. People actually liked it. So I think you're seeing the disappearance of these just sort of mercenary product movies and people really rallying around things that they like. I don't know if that's necessarily a coherent answer, but I mean, I think there's always been great films and mediocre films, and there still are probably the same percentage of them, but things have a tendency to catch on and become like real phenomenons, commercially and critically, maybe in a way that they weren't always doing previously.
Okay, since that segue is perfect, I'm going to go straight into Get Out. I'm going to ask you about the summer movies after. So I have a confession. The last few times that I had you on, I had seen Get Out once. I was like, yeah, this is pretty good. And you were like raving about it. And then I told you that Birdman was my favorite movie to win the Oscar in the 5 years. And you laughed at me. So I was like, I'm not going to get into like Get Out with him. But then I watched it a few more times. And so much better for me after, you know, the plot twist and all that, to me is just absolutely brilliant movie. I actually think it's probably my favorite movie from the past 5 years. Like, there's just so many little things about it that make it so cool. So I wanted to get your take if you think there's been a better movie out since. And I think Get Out, what you described, the word of mouth and giving it promotion, that's the best example that I can think of that. So I wanted to get your take on if you think there's been a better movie since. Is there maybe a movie coming out that might fall in that stratosphere? And if you think 20 years from now, people will be talking about Get Out the way we talk about Pulp Fiction now?
Man, that's a lot. And just for the record, just to start off with, there's absolutely nothing wrong with loving Birdman. Some of the smartest people I know, some of my best friends love Birdman. Like, that's a personal thing. It's a very divisive movie. There are deeply intelligent, considered opinions on both sides. So okay. don't let me shame you into liking a movie that smarter people than me like just as much. But as for, you know, I don't know if I'd say it's the best movie that's come out, but I don't think there's been a more important movie. Just in the sense that it was just as successful as it was. I mean, and you want to talk about movies. I mean, that's Get Out is sort of the test case for what I was talking about earlier. In the sense that, I mean, it's not like a tiny indie. I mean, they had Universal Pictures is behind that. But it was a small movie. It was a movie that would not seem to have blockbuster potential. And it did, I mean, I think it did almost $200 million. It's crazy. And The Quiet Place actually kind of followed a similar sort of trajectory to that, which is that, you know, Get Out had sort of quietly come out at Sundance. It wasn't in competition. I think it was sort of like a last minute screening that they did and built up this buzz and then just exploded when it came out in the later in the spring. And Quiet Place did the same thing. That came out at South by Southwest and sort of started its campaign there. So it's definitely important in the sense of like, smaller studio movies learning how to use festivals when they're actually good. And I think it's just, I mean, you've already seen, I mean, this is kind of a side note, but in the last month I went to see two movies, two pretty cheap and not very good movies that were literally thrillers about black people from the cities going out into kind of the white country and being terrorized by these crazy white people. There was Breaking In and there was a movie called Traffic. Neither of which were particularly good. And obviously that's not what made Get Out great. Like you're copying like the most obvious, you know, element of the film's success, but just the fact that it's been like basically mimicked twice year after it came out just shows you how much that landed. But I think as far as its importance, and I don't know, it's hard to think of like a, you know, comparing to the great sort of indie successes of the 90s. But I think it is just a movie that managed to say so much about the era it came out in without preaching and without...
Yep.
There was nothing about that movie that patted you on the back. You know what I mean? Like, Hollywood loves to make movies that it thinks are socially important, and it really makes them in the way where you're supposed to watch it and think, okay, this is important. I'm doing my due diligence by watching this. I'm a better person because I agree with this movie. And that's not what Get Out was, you know?
Yep.
Get Out was... It was entertaining. It had subtext that it didn't hit you over the head with, and it kind of was willing to make you uncomfortable and not just congratulate you for being a you know, good liberal moviegoer, you know what I mean? So I hope more people take what Get Out did right as opposed to just literally copying the premise. But I think I don't think there's been a more important movie to that's come out since. And, you know, Jordan Peele's got a new one, so I'm really excited to see what he does with that.
He's got a tough act to follow, because when you know what happens and you watch all the little scenes, it's amazing how well, how all the little details, how perfectly they're executed. So let me ask you, I know you can't say too much about these movies, but you've been starting to watch all the big summer blockbusters. So we have Solo, Deadpool 2 coming out. We have the new Avengers movies making a ton of money. So tell us a little bit about the landscape of summer movies. Tell us what you've seen that you've liked and what you're looking forward to.
Sure. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, I have just in the next couple of days, reviews of Deadpool 2 and Solo. So I can't like get into too much detail with them. I mean, I will say that they're fine and that they're decent times in the movies. I think Deadpool 2 is better than the first one, but I wasn't a huge fan of the first one. There's something about it that reminds me of like a 14-year-old who's really smart for his age, but not as smart as he thinks he is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like he is kind of clever, but he's so eager to pat himself on the back for being clever that you just kind of can't really.
I think you described half of my Twitter followers right there.
Yeah, Deadpool is a Twitter thing you'd come to learn. But there's something weird about just the fact that Deadpool is so huge, and it's really, I mean, it's a satire of the comic book movie, and yet it's as popular as these actual comic book movies are, which just kind of shows how much of our diet is consumed with just these giant spectacles, you know what I mean? Because it's like, I mean, I think of like, you know, in the 90s, you had like the Naked Gun movies or Hot Shots or something, and, you know, I mean, everyone saw those, but those weren't making like, you know, $600 million. So it is kind of interesting that even a comic book movie that tries not to be a comic book movie still makes the same kind of money as a comic book movie. And Solo is also good. I mean, there was a lot of worry about Solo because they had hired, you know, the idea was kind of to make a less serious Star Wars movie. And so they'd hired the directors who did the Lego movie to kind of come in and give it a sort of fresh perspective. And then they fired them and brought Ron Howard in to finish it up. So a lot of people were worried it would be a disaster. And it's not a disaster. It's fun. It'll do fine. If you go not expecting a great film, you'll enjoy it. I mean, I do feel like that, you know, they're putting so much effort into these Star Wars movies, and they've gotten it down to such a science that I'm never worried that they're going to be bad in the way that the George Lucas directed sort of prequel trilogy was. But on the other hand, like, you kind of need the freedom to be bad to make something really great in a weird way. Because George Lucas had freedom on that original trilogy to make something great. And then because of that, he had the freedom to make something really, really terrible with the prequels. And so I feel like they've Kathleen Kennedy and the people around Star Wars have gotten so good at avoiding making a bad movie that I wonder if they're not willing to do something that will really make a great Star Wars movie. So this isn't a great Star Wars movie, but it's fine. It's fun. I would not discourage anyone from going to see it. And as far as the rest of the summer, you know, there's actually two movies in August which aren't really blockbusters that I'm really, really curious about. One plays Cannes, I think, maybe in the next couple of days, which is called Black Klansman. Okay. By Spike Lee. And Spike Lee is one of the most interesting American directors because he's made, I think, three of the best American films of the last 30 years. And, you know, he had Do the Right Thing and 25th Hour and Malcolm X. And then he just made garbage. Like, I'm not all garbage. Yeah. He's made some, you know, okay movies. But a Spike Lee movie, like, is the opposite of a Star Wars movie. It can be great, like, culture-changing event, or it can just be like, what the hell is this? So this one sounds pretty far out there. So I'm always cautiously optimistic when Spike Lee is concerned. And then there's another film that I think comes out a little earlier than that called The Happy Time Murders. I don't know if you're aware of this one, but I haven't heard of this one. So it's Jim Henson's son, who's never made a movie before, and is making this movie. It's kind of a Muppet movie, but it's like an adult Muppet movie, sort of in the vein of Roger Rabbit, where like Muppets and humans kind of exist in the same world, and Muppets are second class citizens, and it's sort of like this detective story involving a Muppet detective, and this sort of like the cast of a Muppets style show, being Muppets who are being murdered, and he has to kind of figure out how to stop the Muppet serial killer. It looks like it could be a disaster or it could be brilliant. And as someone who grew up really obsessed with Roger Rabbit, you know, I'm always aware there hasn't really been a movie like that since. So I'm very intrigued by the fact that, you know, someone who grew up around this world, you know, as Jim Henson's son, is kind of trying to bring something like that back. But I don't know anyone who's seen that yet, so
I'll keep my eyes out on those for sure. So let me ask you one final question on a movie that's not coming out anytime soon, but there's a lot of buzz already for it. So Tarantino's been in the headlines a lot for the Me Too, the Harvey Weinstein stuff, but he also has a big movie coming out in next year or the year after, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is about the Manson murders, and I'm really looking forward to this. So let me ask you, as someone that covers the movie business, what's the early buzz on this and what are you expecting from it?
I think the early buzz on this movie is really fascinating because it's all over the place. I think the first time in however long, Tarantino was actually looking for a studio to set this project up under because all of his previous films have been done with, you know, Weinstein. And the studios were just like going all out to lobby him. I think it was Warner Brothers literally redid a part of their lot to look like the lot had looked in the late 60s. And they sort of brought him in. I mean, this is like this giant dog and pony show. There's a lot of excitement around it and with the cast and everything. I think there's also an equal number of people who saw the premise and saw the director and just said, no, thank you. For a lot of reasons. I mean, I think one, the Manson saga kind of feels like it's been just exhumed so many times. I'm kind of sympathetic to that. Not to plug another podcast, but the Karina Longworth has a podcast called You Must Remember This about Hollywood History. And she has like a 7-hour series on the Manson murders and just sort of the Hollywood that surrounded them that I would highly recommend listening to, because there's just so much content about Manson and so much of it is terrible. But I can understand people just being like, why are we going to go to this well again? On the other hand, I think that Hollywood in the late 60s provides a pretty interesting sort of lens through which to view Hollywood right now, in the sense that you had a lot of these guys, like, I mean, you know, you have Manson, and then you also have Polanski, whose wife was murdered by Manson, both of whom were really hideous people to women. And you have all of these people in positions of power in Hollywood who are kind of willing to go along with people who they should know are bad people, who they have every reason to believe they should not be associated with, but they do anyway. You know, like, I mean, even before Manson killed anyone, it was pretty obvious he was fucking insane. And yet you have all of these people, like, you know, Hollywood producers and music producers and Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys just sort of hanging around him because he provides whatever they think they need. And then, you know, like modern Hollywood, I mean, everyone knew, if nothing else, that Harvey Weinstein was a serial sexual harasser, if not necessarily a serial rapist, like we know now, allegedly. And yet we're willing to kind of hold their nose and do business with him. So I think I think Hollywood could see a lot of itself in the LA of the late 60s. I think the question is Tarantino the right filmmaker to do that? You know, I mean, I think it'd be interesting if Tarantino were kind of willing to look at himself in the mirror a little bit and think about, like, what would I have done, you know, with Charles Manson, you know, vis-a-vis kind of the things I was willing to kind of overlook with Weinstein in my own life. I don't know if he has the right taste level to do that, though. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of cringe to think of him sort of fetishistically shooting Margot Robbie's feet as he has, like, this giant bloodbath scene. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I don't know, man. I don't know if this is... I am nervous about the taste level, but I don't think the way some people do that the Manson saga has nothing left to say. I think it has a lot to say about Hollywood today. But it's a real big kind of question mark whether Tarantino's the right guy to really, really get into that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to me because I think we're around the same age. I mean, when I was growing up, Manson was kind of the embodiment of evil. I remember reading all the books about him. And then after that, of course, there was OJ. And I feel like OJ has become like bigger than life right now. And I think there's such an appetite for those that I think it's going to do really well, even based on everything going on, even with OJ and all that. So I'm very fascinated to see, but it's interesting the angle that you mentioned with the studios trying to get him with Weinstein gone. So listen, Andrew, I can't thank you enough for coming on. As always, it's such a pleasure to chat with you. I look forward to your reviews on the movies, your takes on Inter. So thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, David. Always a pleasure.